WSHU's Join the Conversation series is sponsored by IKEA New Haven, the Wyand Cimbali Group, and the law firm of Cohen & Wolfe.
Well, thank you so much. It is so exciting to be here with all of you and with the two of you. Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Woodunn shared a Pulitzer Prize in 1990 when they both worked for the New York Times covering China. Woodunn was the first Asian-American reporter to win a Pulitzer. They won for their coverage. They won for their coverage of the Tiananmen Square movement. And since then, Kristof has won a second Pulitzer Prize in 2006 for his coverage of the genocide in Darfur. Kristof's columns appear twice a week in the New York Times, as I'm sure you know. And Woodunn is now a senior managing director with Mid-Market Securities, which is an investment firm, and she's helping entrepreneurs in emerging markets. They've written four books together: China Wakes, The Struggle for the Soul of a Rising Power; Thunder from the East, Portrait of a Rising Asia; Half the Sky, Turning Oppression into Opportunity for Women Worldwide. And their newest book is A Path Appears. And I understand, I think everybody here has a copy of that now, and you're very lucky, because I've had a chance to read it. It is just beautiful and unbelievably inspirational, and I think I know that you're all going to really appreciate it, because I know that I did as well. The book shares stories of people who are making the world a better place and the many ways each of us can support them and make a difference ourselves. It also looks at the ways nonprofits can be made more effective by improving lives. And it's just full of inspiration and insight, and I'm thrilled that it brings Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Woodunn here today. Please, again, welcome them to this stage. So, I wanted to start, I think, with all of the terrible news that exists, you know, that we hear on NPR and on WSHU every day, especially recently. I think people can be forgiven for allowing a little hopelessness to creep into their view when they think about poverty and disease and violence around the world. But your book presents a more positive view. It's possible to make things better, and even an individual can really make a difference. I feel like that message was really strong throughout the book.
You know, well, first I should just say that, can you hear me okay? Is it on?
Yeah.
It's not?
Oh.
Well,
okay,
goodness.
Then Cheryl
will do all the talking.
Okay?
Can you hear me anyway if I speak up?
Yes. It's better.
I guess those people who can hear me say yes, and the rest don't know what I'm saying, so just shrug. Maybe
we do have this guy as well, actually, in case. Let me hand this to you in case that's not working.
Okay, or maybe backstage somebody can rescue my mic if this is not working.
Well, let's try the this.
Okay.
There we go.
Is that better? Okay. I should also say there's a certain irony that, you know, two people who write about paths appearing should have taken the merit to get here. a little undermines your credibility on paths, I think. you know, on this question of optimism, I think that one of the mistakes that we in journalism make and that the humanitarian world makes sometimes is that we focus so much on the world's problems that we don't adequately acknowledge the progress. And we leave people with a sense that everything is dispiriting and discouraging. And people, you know, then they just want to tune out. And the truth is that, well, in journalism we cover planes that crash, not planes that take off. But the truth is that there are planes taking off all the time. And in the course of my career as a reporter, I've seen it. And, you know, my first reporting, my first backpacking trip through Africa as a university student, what really struck me was the blindness. And it was, you know, it was frankly depressing to see so many middle-aged people who had gone blind unnecessarily from river blindness or from trachoma. And not only were they unable to take care of themselves or to earn a living, but they then had to pull a child or grandchild out of school to lead them around, to look out for them. And these days, you see so much less of that. Jimmy Carter has led the fight against river blindness, and trachoma is something which we write about in A Path Appears, a $40 surgery. And trachoma is an incredibly painful way to lose your sight. And, you know, there was one woman we talked to who, aside from enduring the pain, she had then been unable to tend her fields and had lost two children from apparently malnutrition, starvation, because she was unable to feed them adequately. And then we watched a $40 surgery restore her eyesight. And that, when you see that surgery and you see somebody like that then be able to walk again and look after her children, that is not discouraging or depressing. That is just profoundly encouraging. And the thought that one can accomplish that for $40 is, you know, there is nothing more uplifting. And likewise, on the domestic side, I think, you know, there's still poverty and the cycles of poverty and pathologies of poverty can be discouraging. But what I think is a little bit different from the past is that we now have robust evidence about what works to chip away at that kind of poverty. And the challenge now is to try to implement some of those, not silver bullets, but silver buckshot that will make a difference bit by bit.
There's a very interesting story that we tell in About the Peers, excuse me, by it's a story about a boy named Kennedy. He was born in the slums of Kenya. So if you think the slums here in the U.S. are bad, the slums of Kenya are even worse. And his middle name, his mother was basically a 15-year-old unwed mother. His middle name was Owiti, which means unwanted in the local language. So you can tell how, you know, what future he had. His mother actually, you know, had married another man who was very violent and did not get along with Kennedy, so Kennedy ran away at age 10. So luckily, Kennedy was not very good at stealing. Otherwise, he would have ended up as one of these, gangsters in the slums. He always was a very optimistic kid, and he remembered something that his mother always told him. And she said, when he always feeling hungry and the kids, you know, never ate or anything like that, she would say, "You should be grateful for the things that God has given both the rich and the poor in the same measure, like the light of the sun." So he somehow had a thirst for learning, and although he never went to school, when he met a foreigner, he would want to learn English. So he was the beneficiary of books. The first book he got was a book by Nelson Mandela. Another book he got was a book of Martin Luther King's speeches. So he got very motivated by that and started a soccer club. And then he started street theater. And he just wanted to make people laugh and have fun. And then he started turning to more serious topics because he saw that his two sisters had been raped. And he decided to do street theater about how to address rape, how to, you know, decry, you know, sort of criticize rape and what to do to prevent it. And he got sort of a reputation, and pretty soon he was invited to conferences, and he started speaking. And there was one woman named Jessica Posner, who was a Wesleyan University student, who had heard about this street theater. And so she wanted to go to Kenya to study, and, she sort of wormed her way in and said, "Oh, I'm going to just live like the locals." And she actually literally lived like the locals in the slums. And pretty soon, they struck up a romance. And Kennedy confided into her, his dream to go study, in some formal way, get a formal education. And she said, "Well, maybe you could skip elementary school. Maybe you could skip high school. You can go to college. In fact, they give scholarships at college in the States." And so Kennedy actually applied. He applied to Wesleyan. He had no SATs, no transcripts, and he just talked about his background. And to Wesleyan's credit, they gave him admission with a full scholarship. And so the two of them got married, and they started a school for girls, because girls are basically the most downtrodden souls in the slums in Kenya. And that school has become a remarkable school. In fact, it's raised funds. Kennedy was at CGI, the Clinton Global Initiative, this past week, being spotlighted, and he was spotlighted last year. He's really come of his own. And the school he calls now, it's called the Shining Hope for Communities. And when asked why, and this gets to your question about when asked, why is it that you called it Shining Hope for Communities? And Kennedy said, well, you know, in my life in the slums, I've come to learn that there is one disease that kills more people than poverty, and that disease is hopelessness. So this gets to your point about how important hope is, and there's actually research now being done that shows that hope really is a factor in people's ability to be successful.
And the book talks about all these different ways that we can provide hope to communities and to individuals. And you don't necessarily have to go to Africa like Jessica Posner did. There are ways that we can actually do that here. You follow a single donation made by a woman from California, her name is Shoshana Klein, she received a mailing one day, as I think we all receive these mailings every now and then, and we think, you know, if I make this donation, can it make a difference? And it was about Clubfoot. Can you tell us a little bit about that donation and where that donation went and what it wound up meaning?
Sure. So Clubfoot is it's one of the most common birth deformities. It happens to about one child in 1,000, and one or both feet are turned inward. In this country, you never see it, you rarely hear about it, because it's corrected essentially right after birth. In fact, it was only when we were writing A Path Appears that I discovered that my mom had actually had clubfoot. And this has just never come up because she's, you know, very athletic, very energetic. And in this country, you know, that's what happens, it's corrected. In much of the rest of the world, if you were born with clubfoot, then you are disabled, you're unable to walk, you're unable to go to school, unable to work or marry, and you often become a beggar in the streets. And so we wanted to address, I think, the feeling on the part of a lot of people that I'd like to give, but you just can't make a difference. So we followed the donation of this California woman, Shoshana Klein, who sent in a check for $250 to an organization that addresses clubfoot. And the money went to a hospital in Niger in West Africa. And it benefited a little girl called Rashida from a dusty village, Turadi, that is, you know, has no electricity, no real medical care. In the past, when people had had clubfoot in this village, they had never been able to be treated. They had simply become beggars. And Rashida's dad, she's an incredibly sweet little girl, and he really adored her. And he just could not abide the thought that his daughter would end up being a beggar. And so he took her to a nearby hospital, and they said, well, in the capital, there's some Western-run hospital that actually can cure clubfoot. And so he scrounged up the money to take the bus fare to the capital, Niamey. He took her there. He walked around until he finally found this hospital. And that $250 donation from Shoshana Klein was enough to pay to correct Rashida's clubfoot. And so now she has gone back to the village. Every other parent knows that if their child is born with clubfoot, it too can be corrected. She's going to be able to go to school. She'll live a productive life. And, you know, all for $250 is going to be transformational for that child. And again, that strikes me as extraordinarily inspiring, what can be achieved for relatively modest amounts of money.
I mean, I think it's important to recognize, though, that, of course, you know, her donation didn't solve the global problem of clubfoot, or not even the national problem in Niger of clubfoot, but it really did change the life path for one Rashida.
Yeah, right. One of the things that's truly remarkable about the book is that it doesn't just look at the difference that individuals and charities can make internationally, but also here in the United States. I wanted to ask, here in Connecticut, we have one of the widest economic gaps in the country. And we've actually been doing a series of stories about that called State of Disparity on WSHU. And you write in the book that the bottom 20% economically in the United States have a 1 in 12 chance of making it to the top 20% over a lifetime. What difference does economic disparity make in these kinds of opportunities?
Well, first of all, I'd like to, it's 1 in 12.7, so we can round it up, you can round it up to 1 to 13, right? But the reason that number is so striking is that if you compare it to Britain, to the UK, now, and the UK, you remember, you know, they put out Downton Abbey, so...
they know a thing or two about economic differences.
Right, about classes, societies, but from the bottom fifth to the top fifth, it's 1 in 8 make that transition. So in many ways, they're more upwardly mobile than we are here in the U.S., and other parts of Europe are quite similar in terms of the mobility. So we really aren't really I don't know that we can really call ourselves the land of opportunity anymore. But to get to your question, in terms of the economic disparity, yes, that's, you know, disparity of income, of wealth, of, you know, there's a lot of numbers there. But what's really critical to recognize is that it's also a gap in opportunity. There's a huge disparity in opportunity because not only are those kids who are born in poverty, often they're even born way behind the starting line because if the mother is a single mom, maybe she's very young or maybe she's been on drugs or maybe she's been, you know, drinking. There are a lot of situations that aren't caused by poverty but are correlated with poverty that create a situation where the kids born are way behind even when they are born. And so the key is to really capture those kids when they're young and intervene at the early stage so that you can actually give them the opportunity to shine and really alter their life path. And there are a number of organizations here in the U.S. that actually intervene early.
And you write about the 30 million word gap. Explain that to me.
Well, that's basically the difference between, so a child of professionals by age 4 has heard 30 million more words than a child born to parents on welfare.
It's 30 million
stunning.
More words.
30 million.
The children learn, the children each begin to speak at the same time, but you know, middle class upbringing is full of, oh, you know, what's that letter? Oh, you know, what's this? What's this made out of? You know, they're constantly talking. And working class upbringing sometimes is more authoritarian, less positive reinforcement, more don't do that, and just less kind of talking in general. And part of that is an income issue that people don't have resources for a babysitter, may send somebody to a childcare program that is very inadequate. But it's also, to some degree, cultural. And I think that there is sometimes a sense, I mean, there's this awkward thing to talk about, this sort of parenting gap issue. And it's actually become more of an issue over the last 30 years because middle-class parents have been investing more and more and more in their kids' enrichment programs and sending their kids to music lessons and chess lessons and soccer practice and this and that and that. And so the gap in those enrichment programs has gotten greater over the last generation rather than smaller. But I think that one mistaken less than people sometimes draw is that there's really not much we can do, that this is a family issue and, you know, that there are some folks who maybe aren't great parents and this is just, there's no intervention that can fix that. And in fact, you know, no, there are very, very few people who don't want the best for their kids. And where there are shortcomings, they may be raising their child the way they were raised. And if they get some support, some parental coaching, some help, especially if with this incredibly difficult job of being a single parent, then they can dramatically improve those outcomes. And so we write about some organizations that do this kind of parental coaching. And the result in terms of decline is 79% drop in state-verified child abuse, for example. Coaching parents to talk to their kids, to read to their read stories to their children every night, or if they can't read themselves, then at least take a book and turn the pages and talk about it. And this kind of coaching has a dramatic impact on the parenting styles there. And it doesn't work in every case, but it works often enough to create a lot of this kind of opportunity that Cheryl is talking about. And it seems incredibly unfortunate to me that, you know, one of the best of these programs only reaches 2-3% of the kids who need it in this country.
So let me explain a little bit how it works. It's called the Nurse Family Partnership, and it's the brainstorm of David Olds, who was doing research in the 1960s. And he, you know, what was really interesting, he was working with troubled four-year-olds, and he realized that he was working with four-year-olds, but he actually was too late. There were some kids at that age who had already been so traumatized that they couldn't be turned around. So he developed something that actually starts in utero. Basically, the nurse family partnership. The nurses go out to mothers who are pregnant, and they basically are telling them, don't smoke, don't drink, all right? Don't live around lead. Just be, you know, take it easy. Don't yell. Be calm and gentle. And then when the baby is born, she tells them, well, why don't you breastfeed? Okay? Also, hug your baby a lot. You know, it turns out that hugging is really important for a baby. We do it instinctively, but not all families do that. They think, oh, we want our kid to be resilient. Let's hands off. Let's let him there. And then also talking to the baby and reading to the baby. So the nurse is doing all sorts of things, giving all sorts of advice. And the result is, she leaves this family at 2 years when the kid is 2 years of age. So it's just those basically 2.5 years that she's working with this family. But the results show, as Nick said, 79% reduction in state-verified child abuse compared to kids who did not have the Nurse Family Partnership program. And these kids are half as likely to be arrested by the age of 15 than the controls. There have been numerous studies on this.
Another program you write about that people can so easily support is it's a reading program. It's called
Reach Out and Read.
Tell us briefly about how that works and how easy it is to support a program like that.
Sure. By any chance, is there anybody from Reach Out and Read here? No. Okay. So Reach Out and Read is a program that was started by some frustrated doctors who realized that they were working in low-income areas. They were worrying about colds and earaches, but weren't worrying at all about the cognitive development of those children, which for the long term might be even more important. And they realized that many of these families didn't have a single children's book in the home. And so they started Reach Out and Read, and it's a program that enrolls doctors serving low-income communities, and they get book donations from publishers of children's books. And at each visit to the pediatrician, the pediatrician will give a book to the mom or dad and brief guidance about how to read to your child, ideally every evening a little bit.
It's kind of like a prescription for reading.
Yeah, then they call it, they prescribe a nightly bedtime story to the family. And they've used randomized controlled trials, which is kind of the gold standard of evaluation. And those kids that have been randomly assigned to Reach Out and Read are much more likely to be read to several times a week. They're much more likely to list reading as a favorite activity in the household. And later when they start school, they have a much richer vocabulary. And it's all for, and because the pediatricians are volunteering their time, because book publishers are supplying the books, the cost is only $20 per child per year. It's just an incredible bargain to try to get these kids a little bit of a lift so that they can compete when they get to school. And yet, even though it's only $20 per child per year, only one-third of those kids who would benefit from that in the U.S. actually get that intervention.
The book also talks a lot about how charities could be more effective than they're being right now. There's been a lot of controversy over how some charities use the money, how much of the money goes to needy people. You talk about Pallotta Teamworks, which organized the AIDS rides and some breast cancer walks and things like that. And the company's founder paid himself quite handsomely, and a lot of the money went to organizing the events. But they also raised a ton of money for the causes. And you seem to argue that maybe charities should operate a little bit more like businesses.
Yes, we actually do. We think that there are many techniques from the business world that you can use in the charity world. And some of that is happening, but not as fast as we think it could happen. And also, it's not just the charities themselves, but it's also the world of charity, the donors and the people outside. It's the attitude towards charity. And so what Dan Pallotta did, basically, was he started a fundraising effort for breast cancer. And he was just phenomenal at it. I mean, he did spend a lot of money, huge amounts of money for marketing that, you know, no one had ever spent before on these kinds of issues. He basically launched the, sort of the bike riding and the walks for breast cancer. And he also paid his team and himself quite handsomely. And, I mean, I think it was salaries were really quite high, in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. This is 10 years ago, which was unheard of for someone working in the charity field. And so there's a lot of backlash. But he raised millions and millions of dollars for breast cancer. But finally, the critics got to him, and there was a real sort of confrontation in one place that basically called off his one of his walks at the last minute, so he lost a ton of money. And then the organization that he was raising the funds for just pulled it away and said, you know, we don't want to work with you anymore because you're too controversial. Well, so of course that was horrible for Pallotta, but of course the next year when they did give it to someone else to run it, they raised about maybe 20% or 10% of what he had raised. I mean, a tiny fraction of what he had raised. And so you have to weigh the benefits and the costs. Is it so wrong if he raised a ton of money for the cause? I mean, he was raising millions of dollars. He paid himself, this is net of what he paid himself, so he's still delivering the benefit. But it is a little bit flashier than, you know, for a cause where the other organization that raised money, they raised sort of a, you know, modest amount of money, but they didn't cause any ripples and they didn't do anything that invited criticism. So you ask yourself, well, if you're looking at outcomes, then you would want the Pallotta team. If you want sort of the reputational result, then you go with this side. But I think that charities, and we do think that charities should be really judged much more on outcomes than on traditionally the inputs, like how many donors do you have, how much, you know, what are the inputs. We really should be raised on outputs. And that's got to be a shift. It takes a while to do that. There are some organizations that actually now are evaluating the impact that charities have, and they give recommendations on the best charities that have the most efficient outcomes. But before them, the reason they started this is called GiveWell, these two guys had worked at a hedge fund. The reason they started GiveWell is that they were looking around to figure out which charities are the most effective and have the best outcomes, and they couldn't find any measurement, any information that really spoke to that. So they didn't know how to choose charities. So they went out, left their hedge fund, and they started GiveWell.
Nick, in a column this week on the Ebola outbreak, the epidemic that's happening, you criticized the public response and said that we wouldn't actually have stood for that kind of response in the private world, in the private enterprise world. I mean, should governments be sort of taking more of this sort of model now, something similar to how private enterprise would handle this kind of a thing? What can and should be done about that outbreak?
In general, I think... I don't know that my column is known for its praise of corporate behavior, but obviously there's a lot of short-termism in corporations and worrying about the day share price or the quarterly share price, this kind of thing. But still, at the end of the day, private enterprise does invest for the medium term, for the long term. And in the government sector, we don't even have accounting systems to measure that kind of investment or return. And likewise, in the charity world, we don't have the metrics, we don't have the same emphasis on bang for the buck. And I think that, you know, the would-be beneficiaries are the losers. And it's so frustrating to me that, you know, we should have learned after AIDS, we should have learned after cholera in Haiti, that it is so much better for everyone involved to move into an infectious disease and try to stop it early on. With Ebola, for $100,000, this could have been stopped at the beginning of the year, you know, with simple interventions. And we didn't do that, and it just spread out of control. And now in Liberia, the numbers of people with Ebola are doubling every 2 to 3 weeks. The world may end up spending $1 billion to do it. And that just seems emblematic of the way we approach so many of these issues, that we're unwilling to invest early in life in early childhood interventions, but we're willing to pay for prisons, you know, for people a generation later. And if we were more aware that if you don't invest in the front end, then you're going to end up paying for it in the back end, not only financially, but with a huge human cost as well, then I think that we might reorient the way we allocate some money in ways that would create, would not only be more economically efficient, but would create opportunity and create a more equal society.
One of the problems... I mean, one of the other problems, though, and I think this is true not only of Ebola, but also in certain aspects of the early childhood education, is that there are market failures. And so it isn't easy for a company to say, I'm going to do a vaccine for Ebola, because it's not a regular business. It's sort of like a one-shot deal. Who's going to pay for it? And you know, the poor people aren't going to pay for it. And so the same thing is with early childhood education, is that you know, especially for people in low-income families, who's going to pay for it? And so companies are not going to come in and provide schooling unless they can get it paid for. So somehow, because there's this kind of market failure, there has to be a way to solve that problem. I mean, it could be solved through maybe foundations or whatever, but there has to be a mechanism that should be thought out as to how one can really continue to fund these in a sustainable way. Because Reach Out and Read, Nurse Family Partnership, they're only serving very small percentages of what is needed.
I have so many more questions I want to ask you, but I know I'm not the only one here who has questions. And so I'd like to, at this point, open it up. We have microphones in both aisles now, and I'm completely blinded by the lights, but I can vaguely see that someone's walking towards the microphone over here, so why don't you go first?
As someone who's done a lot of humanitarian work over the last 20 years, I agree with you that it's great that all these people are doing these things on the micro level. What you didn't address, and I'd like both of you to address, is the fundamentals in the world right now. The incredible instability, the real possibility that global change is permanent, it's not addressable, it's too late. And also, you did address at some point, at some time, the income inequality. That's not going to change. I'm a financial analyst. I can tell you that's not going to change in the next 20 to 30 years. Could you talk about the macro level? At how, if you agree with that assessment, or whether you think that's too pessimistic, and if you could both talk about that?
Sure. I'm more optimistic than you on that front. I mean, globally, economic inequality has actually, and wealth inequality have actually reduced, really because of the rise of China and India. And so globally, inequality has declined, even as in the U.S. and in some other Western countries, it has expanded. Likewise, it seems to me that one of the great global changes has been literacy, that for the great majority of human history, you know, most human beings were illiterate. And then since 1950, a majority of people have been able to read, and now 83% of adults are. The number of children, I've been writing about the importance of getting more kids in school globally, and you know, every year the number of kids who are out of primary school is diminishing. Now it's still 60 million, which is way too 60 million too many. But illiteracy seems to me just such a basic kind of metric of lack of opportunity, and that is on its way out. On other points, I would agree with you. I mean, the climate change, I think, presents enormous risks globally. You know, you think of Bangladesh. I covered a typhoon once in which two-thirds of Bangladesh was for a time underwater, and, you know, I worry that that may be something of the future. Anybody who has covered the instability in the Middle East or some of the civil wars around the world, you know, all that is pretty frightening. And I also would agree with you that the solutions to some of these problems, I mean, we talk a lot about individual groups that are doing wonderful life-saving work both here and abroad, and that's important. And, you know, that girl, Rashida, with a club foot, she would be crippled and unable to go to school today if Shoshana Klein had not sent that check for $250. But at the same time, the solution to all kids globally with club foot is not to have everybody just run around and write these checks. It is indeed for, you know, people all over to begin to address these in a more systematic way. And we wouldn't build the interstate highway system by having people go out with shovels and, you know, try to expand it little bit by bit. There's some things that governments actually can do more effectively. Education, I think, is a pretty basic one. And the education escalator in this country and in other countries is kind of broken for those who need it most. And in that respect, I think what we need is, you know, not just people writing checks. We need advocacy. And there are some great groups that are doing that to push these issues higher on the agenda and try to shame governments abroad and at home to do a better job. But all in all, I think I'm a little more optimistic than you, and I hope I'm right.
I mean, I think that one of the things you also have to look at is compared to 1980, when half the developing world was living in extreme poverty. Now, basically only 20% is living in extreme poverty. And, you know, Bill Gates himself has said, you know, we're in sight. This goal of eradicating poverty is in sight, is actually within the next few decades. So that's actually a really very positive trend. And it's basically based on factual, gathering of data that they've analyzed this. So, you know, it's not as though we're just, you know, this is something that is just pie in the sky. So I think that that's important to recognize. I think also sometimes it does get very overwhelming when you think, oh my God, these problems are so large. Look at ISIS coming down the road, Afghanistan and Iraq. These problems loom so large. But I think that what happens is that we do look at the very short term. This is a problem that's right here in the now. And we always forget that, you know, you do have to also invest for the long term as you're also dealing with the short term. So, for instance, Afghanistan, if in 2001 we had actually started investing or helping encourage the spread of education at that time, we would have had, you know, already 14 years of kids who were, including girls, who were going to school. You would begin to actually lay the foundation for change in that culture. And I think that's the same problem we have with ISIS. Obviously, there's no one silver bullet to solve this problem, but we're thinking, oh, military toolkit is the one to go with. But you also have to recognize that there should be steps taken to build the foundation for changing the societies that are creating allowing these global gangsters to be formed. So I think it is easy to feel overwhelmed, but I think that there are ways that if we all sort of sat back and said, okay, this is too overwhelming, we can't deal with this, let's just, you know, check out and stay in our homes. I do think that we have to play a role at least in changing our own society, because no one else is going to change it if we don't try and play a role in doing so.
We have a question over here.
Question and a comment. The question is, you mentioned education. I come from India originally. My first year that I was here, 30-odd years ago, I heard a statement on the news that I didn't understand, and I still, 30 years later, still don't understand. And the statement is X percent, whatever that X might be, of students do not read to grade level. In the cultures where it comes, and you said upward mobility, where it is a land of opportunity, in most other countries, you do not have social promotion. That is a cultural issue that is way beyond any government or anything, because it's in the hands of the parents. And if we don't allow for a child to actually learn before they get promoted, you're raising a group of children into adults who have entitlements, who do not have the skill set to lead, deal with the, you know, life in general. So I'd like to hear your comments on those. My comment is I'm also a Rotarian and currently the district governor for our district in Southern Connecticut. And it's one of the few charities where there is no percentage taken off. And the way they do it is all the money that's donated is invested for 3 years. The investment goes to pay those overheads, and the money all goes to charity. So it's a thing to consider.
Thank you for that. And Rotary does great work on so many international issues, from polio to micronutrients. I mean, there's so many issues that it has been fabulous on. On education, you know, one could have a long discussion about all the ways in which education is problematic, but it always strikes me that one of the common threads between poverty in Connecticut and poverty in Zimbabwe is that the best escalator out of it is an education system that works. And another of the common threads is that for those kids who most need that escalator, again, whether they're in Connecticut or whether they're in Zimbabwe, that escalator is broken. I think that the solutions go beyond just the school system. I think that, as Cheryl was saying, they go to getting kids ready in early childhood to address things like the 30 million word gap. And there are a number of tools now to get parents to, you know, to talk more to their kids, to reduce 5% of kids in the U.S., disproportionately poor ones still get lead poisoning, and that is going to affect their cognitive ability. When lead was taken out of gas, then that raised the average IQ of American kids by about 3 points. And it was one of the great public health triumphs of modern times, unheralded. In West Virginia, you know, I met this little kid we talk about in the book who couldn't talk, right? And the problem was that he had never had his hearing screened. It was actually sort of later. His mom was poor, wanted to breastfeed. There was no one around who could coach her on breastfeeding, so he was a bottle baby. Apparently from that he got an ear infection that went untreated, and so he was deaf completely in one ear and largely in another and didn't learn to speak until this was finally diagnosed at age 3. And, you know, that child is not going to be able to compete in the school system. The problem there, you know, goes much earlier in the school system. So I think we have to talk about education and as a way of creating more equality in this country. But I think the conversation has to be not just about Pell Grants in college, and not just about high schools, and not just about elementary schools, and not even just about pre-K, although that's certainly a very, very important part of it, but also about the earliest years as well.
And when that child was actually diagnosed, it was a screening by Save the Children, I think, right, which is based right here in Connecticut, actually.
Oh, that's right, yeah. Yes. Good for Connecticut. That was a Save the Children screening that made all the difference for that child.
Question over here.
Thank you for your talk. I have a question about corruption, particularly in Africa, but in other parts of the world too. You mentioned a minute ago shaming governments so they would provide better public health. Any thoughts about shaming governments so they don't tolerate or even engage in corrupt practices?
Yeah. You know, I think that's important. I think we can do a lot more on that. Chad is a country that I've spent a lot of time in largely covering the Darfuri refugee crisis. And there was one study in Chad that tried to look at an incredibly poor country, that tried to look at money intended for rural health clinics, aid money intended for rural health clinics. Only 3 cents of every dollar meant for these rural health clinics actually arrived at them. And you see corruption in countries with enormous resources where the beneficiaries are warlords. You also see it in more mundane ways. In so many poor countries, the absenteeism problem in schools is not of kids, not truant kids, it's truant teachers. Teachers don't show up because they get paid whether or not they actually teach. They get paid by some central bureaucracy. And, you know, there are mechanisms where if we have the will and if people in the developing world have the will, they can address these. You know, if you only pay teachers when they show up to teach, then they will show up. And there have been people who have experimented with sending people on motorcycles to randomly drop in on schools to check who was teaching that day, or randomly drop in on government clinics to find out if a doctor or nurse has actually bothered to show up that day, and they only get paid if they were there. And it has a tremendous effect on whether people actually show up. In Pakistan, there were a lot of ghost schools that didn't actually exist. The central government would finance these schools that existed only on paper, and all the money would go into somebody's pocket. And then they posted the list of all the schools, and people could then in a village discover that, okay, you know, what is this school that purportedly exists in this village that in fact doesn't? And so they were able to pretty much get rid of the ghost schools in the state of Punjab in Pakistan. So there are mechanisms, and I think that has to be one important way of improving livelihood at the bottom.
It also is very important to recognize that it takes political will at every stage of the government. You really need some very strong-willed leader to say, this is something that we need to eradicate, corruption. I think in the case of India, for instance, Prime Minister Modi is quite interesting. He seems to be at least, you know, shaking up the system. And a lot of the bureaucracies, which were just, you know, flooded with corruption. I mean, everybody, you know, would charge how many rupees for a stamp. You know, he was, he's now known to be really pulling the reins in on all of his ministers, starting with the cabinet level and going down. There was one ministry that had, you know, a stack of approvals that had not, of applications that had not been gotten to for lots of different programs, and, you know, somehow everything was just, you know, halted. I mean, you can't carry on any kind of business if these applications are just halted up there. So he uses these very interesting pressure tactics. So the Prime Minister's office called the minister himself and said, you have, and he gave the exact number of applications sitting on his desk that had not made it past his desk. The minister was so unnerved that he ended up spending the entire weekend going through all of the applications and processing them. So a lot of times it does take political will, often at the top.
Hi, I have a question and a comment. I just want to thank you, both of you, for all your work. I'm a journalism student here at Sacred Heart, and with a particular interest in human rights. So I found your work really inspirational, and kind of it drove me to choose this career path. My question for you is, you've covered so many stories. Do you have a favorite? And which do you find the most inspirational for you personally?
Well, first, thank you for going into journalism. We need good journalists, good people to go into the field. We also need somebody to come up with a business model. So work on that, too. You know, there are so many that I hesitate to come up with one, but, I mean, there's a woman in Darfur who I spoke to, who I'll never forget, One of the hardest problems as a journalist is that to make a problem meaningful to an American audience, you pretty much have to put a particular face and name on it. If you just write about a broad problem, then people tune it out. But when you put a face and a name on it, you may create a risk for that individual. And so I was writing about rape in Darfur, and there was this woman who was in a camp, a Darfuri refugee, and she had been out collecting firewood with her younger sister outside of the camp, and the Janjaweed militia, she saw them coming, and she sent her 14-year-old sister running back to camp, and then she very obviously ran in the other direction so the Janjaweed would see her, and so to give her sister a chance to escape. And so they did see her. They caught her. Eight of them gang raped her. They beat her very, very brutally. And then she was found later by people after the Janjaweed had left. They carried her back to camp. And she told me this story. And I asked if I could use her name and her picture, and she agreed. But I didn't really know whether this would be a meaningful, you know. I mean, this is somebody who doesn't know what the New York Times is. She doesn't know really what a newspaper is, and I was troubled by whether this consent was really meaningful consent. And so I pushed her on and I said, well, you know, why do you want me to use your story and your name and your picture? Because that may create risk for you. And she said, this is the only way I have to fight back against the Janjaweed, to tell my story, and I really want to do that. And, you know, the courage of somebody like that, who has gone through so much already, and her kind of determination to do her part to tell the stories of people in that situation in the hopes that they would reach and move readers like all of us. I have so much respect for people like that. They take so many more risks than we as journalists do, and it kind of reaffirms me in the importance of this line of work, shining a light, however irregularly, on people like that who want to speak up.
I don't have a particular favorite because there are so many amazing stories, but there is one that I'll tell you. It's the story of this troubled youth who lived in Arkansas in the 1950s. His name was Ollie Neal. And he was a real troublemaker. He would cut classes. He made the librarian cry because he was so bad. Mrs. Grady, she was an amazing, interesting lady. And so Ollie Neal even was shoplifting from the store where he was employed. So he was, you know, a real troublemaker. One time he was cutting classes, and he found himself in the library, Mrs. Grady's library. And he was looking at this book, and he happened to notice that it had a really nice cover. It had a very risque cover. Well, I guess risque for 1950s. There was a woman who was scantily clad, which I'm sure everyone here thinks that she was very well-dressed, but very scantily clad, and it sort of enticed him. And so he thought, But, you know, this is a tough kid. There's no way he's going to check out a book from the library, right? So he stole the book. And he went home, and he read it, and he really liked it. He went back, took the book out, and put it back on the shelf. And there was another book by the same author, Frank Yerby. He took that one, and he stole it as well. So four times he did this. And each time he went back, he couldn't believe that. It was a book that he hadn't seen on the shelf before by Frank Yerby. So this actually, though, really triggered a new Ollie Neal. He started reading voraciously. He graduated from Frank Yerby to Albert Camus. And he really did very well. He graduated near the top of his class. He went to law school. He became one of the first black lawyers in Arkansas. He became the attorney general. He was a prominent prosecutor, and then he became a distinguished judge. So, of course, he was sort of celebrated as one of the most famous graduates from his high school, and he would go back to the reunions. And on one reunion, he got to talking to Mrs. Grady, the librarian. And he sort of confessed to her. He said, "You know what, Mrs. Grady, I got to tell you, I stole this book from your library. I'm sorry, but it did get me reading, but I stole it." And Mrs. Grady then confessed to him as well. She explained that, you know, that first moment when Ollie stole the book, she saw him steal the book, and she was about to confront him. She was really angry. But then in a flash of insight, she realized, yes, this is a kid who would not be caught dead borrowing a book. So she let him steal it. And then she drove 70 miles to Memphis to look for the bookstores to find another Frank Yerby book. This woman, I mean, she wasn't getting her gas reimbursed or the cost of the book reimbursed. She went back and she put that second book on the shelf in the hopes that he would come back and look for another Frank Yerby book. And indeed he did. And a third time, she drove 70 miles to Memphis and bought another Frank Yerby book. She did this four times. And basically, it was out of this woman who, African-American, she really had every reason to be bitter in her life. I mean, she was never had any opportunities, and she had all these troubled kids who were always giving her, making her cry and doing hard things. But here was this big-hearted woman who reached out to help these kids. And Ollie Neal certainly is paying it forward. He has helped many, many other. He's mentored many, many young kids. But Mrs. Grady, I think a statue should be built in her name. And she's a lesson for us all. She truly lived a meaningful life.
Hi. Welcome to Connecticut. And I wanted to let you know that I brought my 11-year-old son with me tonight. We're homeschoolers, and this is a field trip. And I think it's important for him to see and acknowledge the true heroes in our midst, which I consider both of you to be. I wanted to ask you what your thoughts might be on a domestic issue that's really, you know, exploded in the last couple of years, and that's gun violence. And I'm wondering, you know, with such a huge organization like the NRA, who has been really controlling things for so long, what any words you might have for those of us who are trying to create change and move towards more responsibility, not elimination, but just responsibility. One of the things I was most shocked by after Sandy Hook was learning that every week, week in and week out, across the country, there's little children who find guns sitting around somewhere, and they either kill themselves or a sibling or sometimes even their parents. And in many states, there aren't even laws that make that illegal, and nothing happens. Thank you.
It's a good question, and it's one, you know, I've thought a lot about. I grew up on a farm in Oregon in an area where guns were common. Every farm has guns. Our farm had them. And yet it seems to me very obvious that at a time when we're losing more than 30,000 Americans a year to gun violence, that we can do so much to reduce that toll. And indeed, the NRA, as you know, historically was perfectly open to kind of sensible gun measures. I think for me, the best model is what we've done with cars. If you look at auto fatalities, and in fact, I think cars are a good model of the way of addressing all kinds of issues. I said earlier that there are no silver bullets, you know, but silver buckshot. Cars are an example of where we've taken that. We take something that has the potential for enormous destruction, and we systematically try to make them safer. So since, if you look at the auto fatality rate, I think it was beginning of the 1920s, then since then we've reduced the auto fatality rate by per 100 million miles driven by 95%. And we did that not through one thing, but through a million things. We did it through, you know, better seat belts, through better bumpers, better designs so cars don't flip over, padded dashboards, graduated licenses for young drivers, better engineering of roads. And when there's an accident, when there's a fatal accident, then you get researchers who are carefully studying that accident and understanding exactly what went wrong. In contrast with gun violence, we don't even have very good data because the CDC was banned from keeping research on gun fatalities. And there are so many ways we could, we wouldn't eliminate gun deaths in this country, but if there were requirements of how guns were stored, trigger locks, things like that, if there were some research towards smart guns, you need a pin to operate your cell phone, seems to me that maybe a thumbprint sensor or a pin or something to make a gun work might not be a bad idea, or a trigger lock, whatever it may be, but that there are ways in which we could use a sort of public safe, public health model to reduce the toll of guns, and universal background checks would certainly be one obvious way to begin, and they have overwhelming support of the public, and yet the political system has not responded to that overwhelming support. So I'm with you.
I think we have time for just two more questions. We have two people over here.
Thank you for coming to Fairfield. I'm a social worker, and you're a rock star in my field. I was wondering if you could talk for a few minutes about Appalachia. We have someone here, Alita Ward is here. She sends 150 students there every summer to do some great work. And I know you wrote a great column a year or two ago, I don't remember when, talking about the downside of having a culture of dependence there. And I believe in a strong safety net, of course. But I wanted to know your current thinking about Appalachia and how you see the path forward in terms of policies and programs.
When I go to Appalachia, then it reminds me a lot of my own community where I grew up, in this rural community in Oregon. They have very similar problems. These are kind of working class areas without a lot of education, where a generation ago there were some jobs, often union jobs, that provided a decent living. After World War II also, a lot of vets had been able to use the GI Bill of Rights to get some kind of education. And so, in my community, the local big employers where there was a steel mill and a glove factory. And so there were a lot of people who had kind of a middle-class life based on those jobs, and they had a little more education than their parents had, and they hoped that their kids would have a little more education than that. They had stable families. There wasn't much of a substance abuse problem. And then the glove factory closed down. The steel mill employs many fewer people than it did before. And about a third of the people in my high school class dropped out before, did not graduate. And only a handful of us went to college. And those people who didn't graduate from high school, you cannot get a decent job. And one of the upshots of that has been that methamphetamine has just torn people apart. And this is very much the same pattern in Appalachia as well. And then you have family breakdowns. Part of it is that men get in trouble with the law. Maybe it's for dealing with meth. Once they have a prison record, they become even less employable. They become less attractive as husbands. They, often father various kids in various families who don't have a dad at home. And so in fairly short order, a really troubling poverty cycle has been created. In West Virginia now, 20% of kids that are born in the state have drugs in their system. A lot of it is meth, a lot of it is heroin. And it's heartbreaking for me when I go back to my town of Yamhill and see this happening to a community that I really love, and the degree to which you've had all these patterns of drug dependency, family breakdown, kind of blue-collar, uneducated workers who have become kind of disenfranchised and marginalized, and then their kids don't get support, and especially boys kind of get in trouble, don't graduate from high school, and the cycle is repeated. And I do think that there are some things one can do that, again, aren't perfect, but that help a little bit. We talked about the nurse family partnership, trying to, well, even early, I mean, one of the big problems is when kids have kids. And if you work with at-risk teenage girls who don't want to get pregnant and give them support and family planning advice, and also there's some very good programs. We talk about one, the Carrera Teenage Adolescent Prevention Program, that dramatically reduce these teenage pregnancies, and that produce bad results for them. Those girls usually drop out of high school, and also create a child who's going to be at much greater risk. Beginning to work with to try to prevent unwanted pregnancies, then work with these very young babies, work with them through preschool, try to get them ready for school. Mass incarceration has been a disaster because it has further broken up families. I think that one area where conservatives are absolutely right is the importance of family as a unit in society, and the importance of having a more traditional household as a success factor correlating for kids. I think where they're wrong is in the remedies and various efforts to kind of create incentives to create families have basically, they've been tried and they have not worked very well. One thing that has been devastating for the family has been mass incarceration. We've quintupled prison incarceration rates since about 1970, and that has been just catastrophic in so many of these ways. And then again, education. And, it's not so much of what I see in my own hometown is not poverty as a matter of income levels, but poverty is kind of this broader pathology and the kind of hopelessness that Cheryl talked about. And no easy, simple solution, but there are ways of chipping away at it and creating a measure of hope, intervening to at each step of the way to improve outcomes. And I wish that as a society we could build as much consensus to do that and address those kinds of risks as we are willing to address risks that come at us from 10,000 miles away.
Last question.
Hi, I enjoy your column and read it regularly. I worked in a school. I work with special education students. And one problem that I found was not that the parents weren't trying, that the kids weren't trying, but the fact that they didn't have adequate, stable housing. That they would be in the district, then they disappear for 3 or 4 months, they come back, who knows where they were. So these are kids that could actually benefit from their education, could succeed, were cognitively intact, but yet because of their housing situation, there was no stable trajectory. That they would learn something, they'd miss 3 units, they'd come back, they'd fail the next 2 units because they didn't have the prerequisites for it. Are there any initiatives or anything out there to sort of work on this whole housing situation so the kids can actually take advantage of their education?
There are a lot of efforts that have been made on housing. The housing interventions tend to be more expensive than other kinds of interventions. And there's... So I'd say that a lot of the more cost-effective interventions are in other areas, and that's one of the areas where the family breakdown issue has had the most repercussions, because and it's one of the reasons why kids growing up in single-parent households sometimes don't have as good outcomes. It's intermediated through the fewer resources that are available for a single parent, for a low-income single parent, and the fact that they may indeed, as you say, then be bounced around from house to house in ways that are disruptive to their schooling and to the broader social life. So that's a hugely important problem, and there are some efforts to try to address it. But I think if I were kind of looking at where to invest the most resources, I think I would focus on some other areas, especially some of the early interventions. Although, as you say, housing is certainly, you're absolutely right that housing is a crucial issue.
Yeah, things like unemployment, and obviously that leads to homelessness if you don't have the means to actually pay for housing. I mean, these are really critical issues that trigger a whole host of other issues. And so you can't really start solving one problem unless you solve sort of the whole problem. So you do need comprehensive solutions. But there are organizations that tend to be a little bit more local, but that do try and find solutions. In this particular case, for instance, they would try and take the child and place them with someone who does a relative that has a home. So I'm thinking of youth villages. And so they'll look at the kid. They'll focus on the kid, not the parent. They'll focus on the kid, and they'll say, who is there a relative, or they would prefer a relative, a blood relative, and they'll say, they'll work with the relative, they'll give subsidies and help, but they would work with the relative to make sure that the home is a stable place where they're placing the child, just so that the child can have a place from which they can go to school. So, I mean, that's only part of what Youth Villages does. It does a lot more other things, but in that particular instance, yeah, they do have to solve those kind of basic problems.
I don't usually follow the rules, so I apologize to the commentator and to you both. But how does the individual shame our own system? And I'm thinking of things like there are many immigrants within our own system who are slaves to in a brothel. There are our own foster system is broken. How does the individual shame our own government to bring these to light? I not being a journalist and not a writer, I do not have that avenue. I was a nurse. I was a foster parent. So I tried to work within the system. But now, how do I change the government, our own government?
So let me give you the four steps to create a better government in Washington. Oh, my microphone has gone out. I'm sorry. Now, I would, I guess I'd say two things. First of all, at the national level, we obviously have a somewhat dysfunctional government and some very complex problems. And so that seems like a harder nut to crack. On the other hand, at the local level, it may be easier to bring about some changes. And for example, one of the issues we write about, and you allude to it, is sex trafficking. One of the things that will make a difference there is when police and prosecutors in a particular jurisdiction will not just go and arrest 16-year-old girls who were the victims here, but will arrest the pimps and prosecute the pimps and the Johns. And that is a decision that, local voters and communities can raise with the mayor or the police chief. And I think that is indeed happening in a lot of communities. And pimps learn pretty quickly that they're not going to risk, it's just a lot easier to go to a town where they're not going to be targeted, And so that has a real impact. I really believe in those incentives. And I guess the other more broader thing I'd say is we talk in A Path of Peers about some organizations that do this kind of very successful advocacy. And the one campaign is an example at international level. A group called Results, which is at results.org, is an organization that has a terrific record in bringing about change in policies and more funding for worthy areas, because it informs its people about kind of useful interventions, and they will approach their member of Congress, for example, or whoever it may be, and present kind of careful, reasoned arguments. And at the end of the day, in areas that are, that may not work in gun control or very hot button issues, but on some of these areas of public policy, if a constituent has reasoned arguments for some legislation that a member of Congress, that is kind of a plausible bipartisan measure, then that actually can really have impact. And Results has been very, very effective that way. So,
well, take an example. So, for instance, the brothels that you talked about in Nashville, Tennessee. We write about Becca Stevens, who basically said that she wanted to help out these women who were basically forced prostitutes. She is a chaplain at Vanderbilt University, and she started a safe house for these women. And she began just with nothing. She just said, okay, let me get some donors together. Let's buy a house, and we'll be able to house eight women from prostitutes who are in jail. Will give them the opportunity if they want to try and turn a new leaf. And so she started with these women. And as time went on and she became successful, she started adding more houses. But she also, importantly, started working with the police force, the local police force, and also the Attorney General's office. And now she also has an audience with the mayor. They are coordinating policies to focus more on arresting the pimps, but also give training to the Johns. If the Johns are caught, they'll be fined several hundred dollars and get training on what they're doing to these women and actually learn about the backgrounds of these women. Often the Johns have no clue that these women have been forced into prostitution and the lives that they've lived. And so there could be organizations. She's also trying to start a national network. But in your local area, there could be organizations that are similar, that are focusing on these issues, so that you don't have to start something on your own. It just is daunting to start something on your own. But chances are that this is becoming a larger issue, that there are chapters of some of these larger organizations, or there are local organizations that really are trying to make progress on these fronts.
I am so excited that everybody here has a copy of this book. Because I know that you are all going to be as inspired by it as I was. And I'll say that towards the back of the book is a list of six things that you can do in the next 10 minutes. So there's no excuses to not to make a difference after reading this book. They've made it very easy for you. Cheryl and Nick, thank you for the work that you do, and thank you so much for joining us here this evening, and thank all of you for coming.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Cheryl.
Thank you.